Welcome to Bipolar Vortex, Tales from the Tunnel. I'm your host, Kelly Anchors, and this piece is called Debbie. Debbie Shirley left us this weekend, but there is still so much of her here. She lived her life the same way she made a fluffy biscuit, by holding it with care. Don't work it too much, she once told me as she cut in the shortening during her many attempts to teach me to cook. Just pat them gently and place them carefully on the sheet. And every time they were perfect, steaming and buttery and light on the inside with just the perfect amount of crisp on top. Unreal. I tried it on my own and they turned into rocks, into stones. I did it just like you told me to, I cried. And she gave me her adorable little half smile and said, you're trying too hard. Go easier on them. Good God. If only I had listened to her, I would have made delicious biscuits and saved a lot of relationships. During college, when the rest of us were eating cans of tuna fish and eating ramen noodles, she was making fish and rice, cooking lima beans and cornbread, frying chicken. She was the perfect Southern cook. Before I get too swept away, let me start by saying Debbie Shirley was not bipolar, and she did not have mental illness. But it is important for me to tell the story because of how Debbie supported me through some of my darkest times. It's always devastating to lose a friend, especially one so young and kind and amazing and talented. But I think it's even more imperative to tell my story of Debbie because of Georgia. Debbie and her husband Scotty had one daughter, Georgia, and she was the completion of them. Debbie was the proudest mother who ever lived, and that did not change from the day Georgia was born to her first day of kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, third Wednesday in the month of May, 2 a.m. on a Saturday, whenever, wherever. Look at any picture of Debbie around Georgia, and you can see every cell inside of her bursting with love. And because Debbie's love for Georgia was so, so big, and because Georgia was the center of her everything, I want Georgia to hear about any extra Debbie-ness that happened before Georgia was born. I know there's very little that I can do to help with this intolerable sadness. But if there is one thing I do believe in, it's the power of telling stories, and I do have one to tell. Debbie grew up very, very poor in the Appalachian Mountains. Her family often went hungry, and in later years she wrote about it with startling honesty. She came out of this really harsh childhood all the more lovely for it. I mean, anyone would be able to understand if she had serious problems as an adult, but it's as if every single thing that happened to her was tenderizer that made her sweeter. Debbie accepted me exactly as I was, and accepting me as I was, and sometimes as I am, is not the easiest thing in the world, but especially as I was, which was a big, alcoholic, self-centered mess who was often unable to see past the end of my nose. Debbie just wasn't made to be critical or mean, and sometimes it just honestly seemed like she didn't see those traits in the people around her because that just wasn't what was important. I think there was something about the starkness of her childhood that helped her hone in on the essence of people. And by her picking out the good parts as essential, it just made us better by proxy. I met Debbie at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina in the early 80s. She was just the kind of person who would walk right up to you and smile and say, "How you doing?" And suddenly you'd just be friends. I mean, dear friends. I mean, like, count on her at any time friends. I mean, the kind of friend you are lucky to land once in a lifetime. She was beautiful, and that really perfect kind of beautiful, the kind of beautiful where she seemed really unconcerned with her beauty. She was either oblivious to it or it just didn't matter to her that much, which of course made her all the more beautiful. She had this little twinkle in her eye and a little smile. I mean, she had a genuinely sweet smile, but it was also a she knew what was up smile. And she was a lot of fun. I mean, so much fun to be around. A great actress. One of those really rare actresses who could play comedy, do farce, Shakespeare, naturalism. But honey, when it came to playing the quintessential Southern lady next door, she nailed it every time. She was fucking hilarious. We did a ton of shows together in college. And after we graduated, Debbie came and lived with me for a while. And me, her, and Mary Kate Cunningham put on a production in Raleigh that I produced. The play was called Laundry and Bourbon by James McClure. It was three Southern ladies sitting on a porch. One of my favorite memories is we needed one of those old metal glider couches you see out in people's yards. We needed one for the set, so Debbie and I took my stepdad Wayne's van, and we drove all around Raleigh just looking in people's yards for one. And the plan was, once we found one, we were going to go knock on the door and offer the person money to use it for the play. And when we finally found one, and we both were really nervous to go knock on the door, and all of a sudden it just seemed really unlikely that someone would let us borrow it for $20. So I told her we were going to have to steal it and bring it back, which pretty much horrified her. But I promised her we would bring it back, and we had to have it. So we go giggling into the yard. We drag it up to the van, shove it in the back, and tear off and go away. And 3 weeks later, when the play was over, we drove back and ran it into the yard and got back into the van laughing. So after the play was over, she went back to Illinois and I stayed in Raleigh. I know part of her family was living in Illinois. So she goes back to Illinois and I stay in Raleigh, and things start going really downhill for me. I start experiencing extreme panic attacks. I end up in the emergency room multiple times. I think this is really when my bipolar kicked in hard and was first diagnosed. It was also around this time that my parents got a divorce. My mom decided to divorce my stepdad, who had been a major stabilizing force for both me and my sister. And at that time, with my history, you know, I couldn't see ahead that he would remain in our lives and be a big part of my life for the rest of my life. There was a lot of fear and sadness when I got that news. So I decide to go to Kentucky and do a play, and I meet a young, really good-looking, seriously immature man-boy who I convince myself I'm in love with. He was from Texas, and after the play, he went back to Dallas, and I went back to North Carolina, and he said he was going to get us an apartment, and I would move there to Dallas with him, and we were going to be actors together. Great. Perfect life plans, ready to go. So I go back to Raleigh, live with my mom. I'm waiting tables, saving money for my big new life in Dallas. And then he calls and says, "Okay, honey, come on down. I'm ready for you." And so my friends gave me a goodbye party, and I put in notice for my job. And then he calls and says, "There's a problem. You're going to have to wait. The apartment fell through." So I unquit my job, and I explain the situation to my friends. And then a month later, he calls, "Okay, honey, come on down to Dallas. I'm so excited." And I quit my job again. And my friends have another goodbye party for me. And this time, because it's for real, we have steak and red wine. And it's outside on blankets with hanging lights and candles. And I'm crying and hugging them and telling them how much I'm going to miss them so much. And when I get home, I'm kind of drunk from the wine, and I call him, and he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, the apartment fell through again." And now I find out he doesn't have a real job. He's actually selling fire extinguishers door to door. Oh my God. I am freaking out. There is no way I can still live in Raleigh. My friends have given me two goodbye parties. I have quit my job twice. I am not going to live here anymore. I have no idea what I'm going to do. So I call Debbie, and she's living in Westmont, Illinois, running an office where her brother works. She's living in a little one-bedroom attic apartment, and she says, without hesitation, Kelly, just come live with me. Just come live with me for a while and we will figure it out. Just come stay with me. And I am crying and saying, really? Are you sure? And she just says, in the most mothering, sweetest, gentle voice, honey, come on. Just come stay with me. It'll be all right. And so I pack up my pink VW bus and I drive to Westmont, Illinois, and I move in to Debbie Shirley's attic apartment. And right around this time, things get a lot worse for me. I'm having panic attacks daily. I would go to the grocery store and be in the aisle buying, a can of soup, and I would start having a terrible, terrible panic attack. And I would have to get out of the store as fast as possible, but I was too anxious to drive my car, so I would go to a payphone. Yep, ladies and gentlemen, a payphone, and call Debbie, and Debbie would come and get me. And I don't know what she did with my car, but she would get me home and deal with the car and never complain. And this happened over and over. And then it got to the point where I just couldn't leave. So I became agoraphobic. And Debbie would go off to work and come back and cook us dinner and talk to me and laugh. And we would sit on the couch and watch TV together. And she put no pressure on me and just treated me like gold. I cannot tell you how much this means to me that I had a friend who just let me be ill and help me through it without pushing me. And during this time, I started to get night terrors. I don't know what else to call them. It were just extreme panic attacks. I would wake up in the middle of the night with a start, and I would be hyperventilating and just completely full of fear and dread about death and existence. And I was just terrified. And I would go knock on Debbie's door, and she would have to get up and go to work in the morning. And Debbie would say, come in. And I would say, Debbie, I'm having a panic attack. And Debbie would pull up her blanket and pat the bed and tell me to get in. And she would let me curl up beside her. And Debbie would take her hands and run them up and down my arm gently and soothingly start telling me stories. She would tell me stories about going to the circus or going to a zoo, and she would detail every animal and just create these elaborate pictures that were so, so beautiful that I would become entranced and hang on to every breath so that all of my attention was on the story and I was able to escape the anxiety. And she'd do this night after night and let me fall asleep in her bed. And she would get up in the morning and go to work and come back and feed me. And she just nurtured me through this incredibly painful, terrible time. And for that, I am eternally and deeply, deeply, deeply grateful. So after a while, I started to get a little bit better. And Debbie came home and she said, "Hey, Kelly, the steakhouse next door is hiring." And we lived right next door to a funeral parlor, which often had huge amounts of flowers left over from funerals. So, as a little joke, I used to go grab them off the dumpster and fill up Debbie's apartment with them while she was at work and surprise her when she got back. But so, right across from the parking lot next door to the funeral home was a place called Harvey's Prime Rib, which I'm pretty sure was run by a Greek mob. But anyway, Debbie says they're hiring. So I'm like, "Oh gosh, Debbie, I'm so nervous." I'm like, "Will you call them?" And she's like, "Sure, I'll sit here while you call them." I'm like, "No, will you call them? Will you please call them and say you're me?" And she said, "Sure." So Debbie calls them and says, "Hi, my name is Kelly. I saw your ad. I live right across the parking lot. I used to wait tables at Steak and Ale. I have steakhouse restaurant experience. I'm really interested." And so they start asking her questions, and Debbie starts answering in the third person. "Well, yes, she worked at Steak and Ale," and I'm stomping up and down on the ground and pointing at her, you, not me, you." And she's like, Oh, I mean, I worked at Steak and Ale." And she'd talk a few minutes and then she'd slip back into the third person again. And I'd start waving my arms crazily, like, "No, you." And then she'd kind of look at me and then, Oh, I. Well, shockingly enough, they said, "Come over for an interview," even though she was slipping from first to third person. So within 30 minutes, we walked together across the parking lot and she sat with me in the lobby. And then they called me into a table and interviewed me for about 10 minutes and gave me the job. And so that was the beginning of me getting better. And I lived with her and I waited tables there for probably 6 months. And then I was finally able to get myself together and move into the city. But I mean, I don't even know how to say it. Nothing would have been okay without Debbie nursing me through that horrible, horrible time. Debbie was a writer, and I'm adding a link to this page so people can go read her poetry and prose. Debbie made her exit right at the end of September, and now it's the beginning of October. So I'm going to read her poem, Come October. Come October, I seem always to be meeting myself again, as if I've been away or forgotten, to look up for a very long while until light, oh light, that honeyed autumn light, drips a long, low nod across the southern sky, catches my breath and holds it until I return fully to this body, eyes open. And still enough to see the luminous leaves of this golden ash, the soft-shouldered waltz of the morning doves, the view from these eyes, this moment. Debbie, I love you.